I have oxidized my Linux, and I'm not just talking about our usual ramble down the A to Z of modern Unix and the Rust-based tooling. I have gone right to the very heart of the matter and changed the very fundamental commands that we use on a daily basis to Rust re-implementations.
Is that a good idea?
Yes.
But why, sir? Why?
Well, curiosity, and also, you could argue, security. So what I have been inspired by is friend of the show John Seeger, who's VP of Engineering at Canonical for Ubuntu. And he's made a number of posts on the Ubuntu Discord about oxidizing Ubuntu. And in Ubuntu 25.10, which is coming up in October this year, there's going to be the first debut of changing some of the fundamental core utils with this Rust re-implementation, which is known as UUtils. And UUtils has a number of projects at different sort of stages of completedness. And the ones that I've been experimenting with are the core utils replacement, the diff utils replacement, and the find utils replacement.
Are there any noticeable differences in the way the commands function? I mean, yeah, there's the potential security advantage. I understand that. But like when I run ls, I pretty much know how that's going to come out. And when I cd, I know where I'm going. Do they like, you know, work upside down, or do they take you like somewhere strange, or do they just work exactly the same?
So there's a couple of interesting points there. So the first is, unlike something like BusyBox, which is an alternative set of core utilities, the UUtils implementations are re-implementations. So although they're written in Rust, they are being tested against the test suite for the GNU core utils, find utils, and diff utils. So they are compatible with all of the switches, options, and arguments that you would ordinarily use, or at least that is what they are striving toward.
Today I learned there are test cases for core utils, diff utils, and the other one, find utils.
Although I have done this on NixOS in order to just see, well, does it work? That was one of the questions I wanted to answer. And I also wanted to try this out because I've changed jobs and I'm now working in a more security-focused sort of organization. And I'm thinking, well, with memory safety being top of mind, as well as, you know, removing vulnerabilities, maybe looking at these tools could be, you know, a positive upside in terms of, you know, increasing the security profile of the operating systems that you're deploying. Not that you would need all of these tools, you know, in a container or production VM or whatever, but it's an alternative. So I did want to test their compatibility, but I was more motivated to do so because of what John has been posting on the Ubuntu discourse, because I imagine he and a small team have been sort of doing a gap analysis and seeing where the rough edges are with this. And Canonical are actually sponsoring engineering work in UUtils in order to address some of the issues that they've discovered. And in fact, when I last looked, all of the major issues that Canonical had identified have been fixed and are in a released version of UUtils.
You and I, we're big fans of shell scripts. Mm-hmm. And I know, like, if you swap out your shell from bash to fish or to zsh or whatever, the shebang at the top of a script will maintain compatibility because it tells it to go and use bin bash or env bash or whatever. Is there some way in which, like, if I'm running scripts that heavily rely on these utilities and I have expectations when I write the script of what the output's going to be and what the performance is going to be, is there any way for like backwards compatible? Like, can I run a script and say, make it use the old tools because I know this script is broken with the new tools?
So that's an interesting question, and I've been able to test that. Now, what I'm about to describe is from the NixOS point of view, but we'll have links to the posts that John has made on the Ubuntu discourse. So for those of you that are listening to this and are interested, John has made a tool called Oxidizer, which will replace the core utils with these Rust re-implementations, and you can switch between them. So you can try this stuff out for yourself. In my Nix configuration, I have over 100 shell scripts. And one of the properties of Nix is when you have a shell script that you integrate into your configuration, you can say for each shell script, this is precisely the dependencies that this script requires. So I rather gung-ho changed all of the dependency links for all of my scripts to use the uutils alternatives. So there is no core utils or diff utils or find utils from GNU on my system anymore.
Golly.
And I thought, this is either going to work or it's going to be a miserable fail. And I did this about 6 weeks ago, and I can report I have no issues. I have no findings to report. It has just continued to work.
But is it technically possible for you to have, for example, both versions of CP installed?
Yeah.
And you would just call them like you call any other command if you had two, I don't know, Firefox binaries. You would just call them by whichever paths and set your actual path to point at one of them first, and that would be the one you get when you run CP. Yeah.
Yeah. So on Nix, I could do that on almost like a line-by-line basis. I could actually have life. I know that there is a particular line in my script that requires date from core utils. I can actually make that one line just use date from core utils and the rest of the script use the re-implementation. And the reason I mention that is today I was working on a script that passes date format strings from a token generator. And this was the first time I found that the implementation of date in uutils just didn't format the string correctly. So for that one script, I said you can go and use core utils as opposed to the uutils, because it absolutely required a feature that is a failing test in the uutils project.
So that's fine for the Nix people, but what about the 12 of us who are running something other than Nix?
Well, like I say, if you're on Ubuntu, John has got Oxidizer, and that will replace core utils and diff utils. So diff utils is things like diff and CMP, and then find utils, which is find and locate and xargs and things like that. So you can like experience this on a more mainstream Linux distribution, let's say. And the other thing that's at the heart of this, and this was the one that I was most cautious about, is there's a project called sudo rs, which is a sudo re-implementation. Now, unlike the uutils project, they are specifically not re-implementing everything that exists in sudo, because they're saying that there are some things in sudo that we don't need or shouldn't have in like the modern world.
Mm-hmm.
So they're being very deliberate about what they implement. And I've also replaced sudo with sudo rs, and it works just fine.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been really good. I mean, there's no performance benefit that I can discern. Everything other than literally today, this date string passing thing, which was a very sort of, you know, specific format that was being requested, it has all just worked. And one of the reasons I wanted to look is I know Ubuntu is switching over to all of this. So by the time Ubuntu 26.04 comes round, which is the next LTS, all of the core utility underpinnings and sudo in Ubuntu will eschew the long-standing GNU implementations for these new Rust versions.
When you mention GNU, I am reminded that these utilities are licensed under the GPL. Are the Rust re-implementations also GNU, or are they under some other license than GNU? And could that be one of the motivators why some people want to switch to these tools?
I hadn't considered the license point of view at all, and I just had to have a look. They're licensed under the MIT license. So
fancy that. Who would have guessed it?
So, there it is. This is the brave new world. And earlier on, it was funny that I think the commands you mentioned were ls and cd. I couldn't really tell you how those work because I've replaced LS with EZA and CD are replaced with Zoxide. So they are other Rust utilities that have, you know, given me supercharged versions of those commands. But in my shell scripts, you know, things like cut and head and tail and all of that stuff, you know, that's all there. And it all seems to work just as I would have expected it to.
I would like to talk to you about the continuing adventures of Nerdy Day Trips, a website I spoke about in the previous episode.
So how's it going?
So we had a soft launch, I guess. It wasn't really like a proper launch. I didn't put a press release out or anything like that. I just made the site live and then posted a little bit about it on social media and shared the link with a few friends. I didn't spread it far and wide. And then also we talked about it on the podcast. So it's had some traffic. People have come and visited the site. I know that. We've also had people submit new sites. On the first day, it was quite a lot. And it tails off, unsurprisingly, because there's an influx of people on the first day. And then, as with most websites, it kind of tails off unless you have some other promotion or some reason for people to come back. Mm-hmm. And the submissions vary. There's a lot of train-related museums. There's a couple of tank-related museums and other nerdy things that people have submitted. But what I've also had is a lot of edits and deletions.
Yeah.
My good friend Hugo has done a lot of deletions and edits to add URLs to pages or delete places that are either not appropriate because they're just a vanity submission, or the place is now closed, or it's moved and the lat long needs to be updated. So there's a whole load of edits that have been done. So that's been really useful to make sure that the data is clean. Because remember, I mentioned last time, I imported a whole bunch of data from the original nerdydaytrips.com, and some of that was duff. So cleaning that up has been quite an exercise, and Hugo's done quite a dent in that so far.
So given that one of the reasons for the collapse of the original site was kind of like spam and, you know, all of that sort of stuff, how have your sort of controls held up to an influx of new submissions and edits? And do you have a spam input problem?
Not yet. I'm not saying we won't have it, but we don't currently have a spam problem, probably because there's not enough eyeballs and there's not like press articles pointing to it that brings up the page rank that causes people to decide to spam the site, right? So I'm not a target right now. So the way it works is I created an ad page. So it's ad.nerdydaytrips.org.
Not an advert.
No, ad. So if you go to the front page of nerdydaytrips.org, at the top, there's a little ad, ADD button. And if you click that, it takes you to the ad form where you fill in the lat long, a bit of detail about the venue. And you can optionally put your name or a nickname to be assigned as you posted that. I had some suggestions from other users who gave me some ideas to improve that, and I did. And now you can just paste an OpenStreetMap URL on the page, and it will get the latitude and longitude from that and some other data from it as well that it puts in the page, and you can fill in the rest yourself. Or you can move a little map around and drag a pin over the place where the venue is that you want to add, and that will get the lat long, or you can just paste a lat long in if you know what it is. But I think having a place where you can just paste a URL or dragging a little pin is okay for now. There are other ways we can improve it, but that's okay for the moment. On the topic of spam, when you add a new venue, it goes into a queue. It doesn't actually hit the website. It doesn't go into GitHub at all. It goes into a D1 database in Cloudflare, and there's a separate page that is an admin tool, which is just basically a form that lists all the outstanding venues that have been submitted, and it presents a link to Google Maps and OpenStreetMap that I can click on and see where it's pointing to on the map, and the URL that the user entered to the venue. So I can see what the venue is, and I can see where it is on the map, and then I can just zoom in and see if I can see the venue on the map, in which case, yes, they've put it in the right place. And then I can hit approve or reject, and most of them I hit approve. And as soon as I hit approve, it creates a pull request with the right formatted data for the Hugo website, and also gives me an intermediate step where I can edit any of it. So sometimes I have to edit things, but I've done a bit of error correction now, so I don't have to edit them quite so much anymore. There's the odd thing I edit, like change the format of a URL or change an apostrophe or something, but most of the time I just hit approve and it creates a pull request, and then at some point that gets approved, and then that's on the site. So there hasn't been a spam problem yet.
Okay, so you've just reiterated there what I remember, which is it's using Hugo, a static site generator. So how on earth does your ad form work with all of these interactive features and a database?
So when you hit the ad page and you fill it all in and then you press the submit button, as long as you've filled in all the fields that are required, that just gets stuffed into a SQL-like database, which is a D1 database in Cloudflare, one row per venue. And the admin page, when I click approve, it shows actually a dialog box with the Hugo formatted stuff in, and the admin page converts the SQLite database row into the front matter that's recognized by Hugo, and the description goes beneath that. So it's not really that hard, because it's just, is it TOML or YAML or whatever the other one is? It's structured data, and so it can create that very easily. And then I just press the button and it creates a pull request. It's easy.
And it's a static page that does all of this.
The ad or the admin page?
The ad page.
No, neither of them are static. Well, they're a single HTML page, but when you hit submit, it calls a worker function in Cloudflare that does the validation and submits it into a database. So that data gets submitted to a JavaScript bit of code that's running in Cloudflare. And that then does whatever it needs to do in order to put it into the D1 database. It's just an insert into the database, right?
Mm.
With a bit of sanitation, obviously. And then the admin page just does a select on that database, that same database. And when I hit approve, it runs a different piece of code, JavaScript code, which is another Cloudflare worker that can then use a GitHub token to talk to the GitHub API and create the pull request, which is, I think that workflow works quite well. Now, it won't scale. If thousands of them come in each day, then I'm going to have a bit of a problem. I've thought about ways to work around that. For example, I could have an allow list of people by looking at the nickname and, and IP address or whatever, and then allow those through because I recognize those people that have submitted, but I have to be careful with that because, you know, people can submit a bunch and then submit bad ones, or, you know, there's various ways to exploit that kind of thing. So I'm being very careful not to just open it up and expose it to the internet and allow anyone to submit anything. Although anyone can just create a pull request on the repo and add a venue. But the thing that protects against that is they've got to have a GitHub account. And if they ruin that, then potentially they get banned off GitHub. So I'm relying on them a little bit there.
So I think this podcast has got a lot of explaining to do, because here you are, like, borderline cloud native developer now, using D1 databases and worker services and all of this stuff. I mean, and containers and Docker is now a daily activity for you. I think if nothing else, this podcast was worth doing just for the journey that we've gone on.
Yeah. And actually, I've quite enjoyed it. It's been a new project for me, I know Hugo and I know a little bit of JavaScript, enough to be dangerous. And HTML is not that hard. The thing that I have the hardest time with is CSS. That's the thing I'm having real trouble with.
Yeah, I agree.
Making it look nice, for sure.
Just to make sure that I'm following properly, when you mentioned earlier your friend Hugo, you weren't being cute about your preferred static site generator. There's actually a person involved called Hugo, as well as a piece of technology.
Yes, there is a human meatbag called Hugo, who I've known. He was one of the first people I met at my local Linux user group, and this was 21, 22 years ago, something like that. And I haven't been that evil to him, because he's stuck around and he's contributed to this thing. So, like, I can't be that terrible a person. But the other thing I wanted to mention is that I have a Discord server as well. I've completely gone off the rails now. I've got a Discord server, and every time someone adds a venue, I put a hook in the ad page and it actually sends a notification to a special channel on the Discord server. So I get a notification on my desktop. I didn't have to build any notification platform, because I just turn on notifications on that channel in Discord, and I get a ping every time someone adds a new venue, which makes it very easy for me to know when new ones have been added. I don't have to go and hunt it down, because I just get a ping every time.
And if you do get thousands of submissions, it sounds like you've got enough gubbins here that you could have a team of moderators to help sort of shoulder the burden.
Yeah, I've got the Cloudflare admin page is locked to certain GitHub user accounts. And currently it's only mine, but I could add other GitHub user accounts to that and make it so that other people could administer the page. But one thing I need to do before that is change the API key, because it currently submits everything as me to GitHub. So you see me doing an awful lot of contributions, and it's not really, it's everyone else's contribution and me hitting the approve button. I need to create a bot account and change the API key. And there's loads of other things, and there's issues in there and conversations in there and stuff. It's a nice little side project. I'm really enjoying it. And if anyone wants to contribute, then join the Discord or join the discussion or file issues or whatever you need to do, or just add venues. All of those things are super useful.
We recently adopted the class caterpillars from my daughter's school.
Well, this brings back memories. I think I did caterpillars and locusts, believe it or not, and tadpoles.
We had a cuddly teddy bear, but it was a different kind of school altogether.
So I think my daughter's class was studying life cycles, so they had one of these kits you can get where you get some caterpillars and the little pot of food, and they're in like a mesh thing, and you watch them grow and turn into chrysalises and hatch, and then you release the butterflies.
Ah.
But unfortunately, this coincided with half term, so they were looking for volunteers to take the caterpillars home while they turned into chrysalises. And as my daughter had become quite enamoured with them, we thought we would volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
And while we had them, I thought it would be fun to take a time-lapse video, which we could then share back with the school so that
the rest
of the class could see the process.
Was this so that you could prove that you hadn't like replaced them when they all died in your custody and just replaced them with ones that look very much like it? You've got a constant camera on them, so all the students can know Mark and his family didn't kill the caterpillars.
Yeah, we didn't just go into the garden and like catch a load of butterflies and stuff them in a bag, no.
Right.
So I started looking at how I might set up a time-lapse camera, and as has been previously mentioned, I have some Raspberry Pis and camera modules lying around at the moment. So I set up a Raspberry Pi and a camera module too, pointing at the caterpillars.
How did you find getting the whole camera going on a Raspberry Pi?
Right, so I plugged it in and I ran the, I think it's RPi Cam Still tool, which has a time-lapse function, and that worked. The problem is that I had a camera module too, which I think I've mentioned before has quite a distant focus set by default and doesn't have a mechanically adjustable focus, so it wasn't getting a very good, you know, you couldn't really see what you were looking at, just some sort of gray blobs. But I did look up and found some guides showing that you could actually adjust the focus manually with a pair of tweezers or a pair of pliers by very carefully pinching it and twisting the lens to adjust the focus. Guess how well that went.
Not well.
Did you put the tweezers through the lens or something?
No, well, whatever I did, I now have a non-working Raspberry Pi camera module version too.
Just the module. Did you manage to nuke the Pi as well, or did you just...
No, the Pi's fine. And this didn't upset me too much, because this focus issue basically means that it wasn't going to be useful for anything I would have wanted to do with it anyway. So moving on from that, I had a bit of a think, and I found an old Android phone, I think a Samsung Galaxy S9, in a drawer, which we don't use anymore. And that's got quite a good camera on it. So I thought I'd give that a go. And we've got a little tripod with a sort of phone mount. So I set that up pointing at the caterpillars. And I found a few apps for doing time lapses in the Google Play Store. I plumped for one called Velocity Lapse, which did what I wanted. And then I basically told that to take a picture every minute and plug the phone in, so that it wouldn't die, because the reason we don't use it anymore is because it doesn't really hold a charge. But that's fine, because I could leave it plugged in. And then I just left it there for several days, taking a frame every minute. And then at the end, you stop it and it sticks it all together in a video.
And that's it? It just works?
Yeah, it just works.
Nice.
It's pretty good. And yeah, obviously all that's configurable, how often you want it to take it. And you can then configure the frame rate of the export and so on. So that gave me a video that was a couple of minutes long. But then I realized I didn't really want it all going at the same speed, because this is going to be played to a class of 5-year-olds with famously short attention spans. So what I wanted to do was have it speed up in the bits where not much was happening, because it turns out that, you know, once you've got a caterpillar and a chrysalis, it kind of just sits there. And slow down the bits where you could actually see them transforming so that you could see a bit more of the detail. So I installed another app called UCut, which is a video editor for Android. Both of these are sort of freemium apps. Most of the sort of basic functionality that I was interested in is all free. And then you can buy extra features like, you know, different filters and star wipes and so on. But for my purposes, this was brilliant. And considering that I was editing on, you know, a 5-inch screen with my fingers, I'm really impressed how easy it actually is to edit a video with apps like this. Like I could pick the bits I wanted and cut the video up and change the speed of each clip and then just have it export it all again as another video with bits sped up and slowed down.
It's a shame that you weren't able to use the Raspberry Pi and you had to switch to a phone, because I feel there was an opportunity here to use something like OpenCV, and every time it spots a caterpillar, it could hook up to Bookshelf Buddy and read The Very Hungry Caterpillar.
Oh, get you in your vertical integrations.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, it is a bit of a shame, I think, that the best video editor for Linux is actually on Android. And even though you got to do it, you got to fat finger it on a tiny screen, it's still better than anything I've used with a keyboard and mouse on any OS, I think. I'm sure, you know, there probably are other video editors available on other systems which are similarly a bit more intuitive than some of the other things I've used. But yeah, it would be great if there was something which was as usable as this for simple video editing on the desktop as well. The final thing I needed to do was publish this somewhere so people could watch it and I could share it with the school. So I put it up on MakerTube, which is an instance of PeerTube, a Fediverse-enabled, self-hostable YouTube alike. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes. I also thought it would be nice for me to throw a few pennies their way to their Patreon, because it did occur to me that hosting a site like that is probably not a cheap thing to do off your own budget. So I thought if they're going to be you know, hosting my videos for me, it would be a nice thing to throw a few quid their way. So yes, I will put a link in the show notes, and I'm very impressed with how this went.